Got it. Okay, we are recording. Okay.
That should be fine.
Okay, folks, we're talking about Foucault. We're going to continue to talk about Foucault over the next couple of sessions. Remember, you know, Foucault's great innovation is to say that the way that modern philosophy has dealt with the question of power is not sufficient for the modern era. And it's important to recognize that the way that philosophy deals with the question of power is itself a function of the modern era, namely the theory of power as sovereignty. This doesn't belong to the Middle Ages. It doesn't belong to the ancient world. Sovereignty is really a topic that gets raised in the 1600s. And we're well into the modern era by the time of the 1600s. Hobbes is the great philosopher of sovereignty. And Hobbes also, remember, is the first social contract theorist. So the whole tradition of social contract theory that follows from him has sovereignty at the center of its analysis. And sovereignty is, of course, the power that is held by the state. And the state, remember, is not simply another social institution. There are many social institutions. But what defines the state as a social institution is the special kind of institution that it is that the state alone wields the right to use violence legitimately. You know, the state is that body in society, as Max Weber says, that has a monopoly on the legitimate means of violence. Any other exercise of violence by any other social authority is illegal, except under very restricted circumstances. I mean, obviously, you can use violence in defense if you're attacked, but certainly the use of aggressive violence by any other agency in society is illegal. And Hobbes very carefully accounts for this. You know, the reason why the state has a monopoly on the legitimate means of violence, according to him, is that we need to create such a body in order to protect ourselves from the violent and aggressive actions of others. And in the state of nature, everyone has a legitimate right to exercise violence, but the result is, as Hobbes says, a condition which is solitary, poor, nasty, brutish, and short. We all have a stake in ending that, and we do that by creating the state, which monopolizes the legitimate means of violence, and therefore enforces the law that brings us social peace. Now, that's at the center of the modern theory of sovereignty, but Foucault points out that sovereignty does not exhaust the analysis of power in modern society, and that in fact the framework that places sovereignty at the center is blind to a very important dimension in which power is exercised. Not by the state, or at least not by the state principally, but by a series of institutions that are unique to the modern era. You know, and you remember what those institutions are: schools, hospitals, prisons, mental asylums, factories, although Foucault doesn't place a big emphasis on that. It's in the background of his analysis, and so on. All of these institutions are faced with having to get people to behave in a certain way, and not simply in such a way as to obey the law. Now, the law basically tells you not to do things. You're under interdiction by the law. Don't kill anybody, right? Don't neglect to pay your taxes. What else is against the law? Don't drive on the left-hand side of the road in the United States, right? But prohibition is, you know, a simple thing. It's a simple concept anyway. You can tell who's doing it and who's obeying the law and who isn't. But the purpose of the second kind of power is not to prohibit. It is to structure and to organize and in a certain sense to create capacities in people that are necessary for living in the world that we're in. And so the second kind of power, which Foucault calls disciplinary, once again, remember, it's not prohibitive. The disciplinary power, according to Foucault, is productive. It brings into existence new forms. And in particular, the forms that it brings into existence are, to begin with, forms of bodily motion. You know, the whole point is to, if you want to put it this way, you could say it's to program the human body on its most fundamental micromuscular level.
You said it was the structure organized and created what?
I said new forms. The forms is simply an empty word here. If you want to fill it in, what the forms are that it creates are forms of bodily motion. Bodily motion. And bodily motion, which is, as I said, micro in character, you know, small scale. We're talking about the ability to make very subtle and precise muscular adaptations. And you might want to think of it, although he doesn't use the word script, but I think it's probably a good word to use here. It's as though there were a script that we were all being asked to act out. But the script doesn't involve principally the production of words, although it can, you know, involve that too. It involves principally the assumption of bodily postures in a sequence. And, you know, the postures involved, for example, in lining up to go someplace. The postures involved in sitting at a desk. The postures involved in eating properly. You know, the postures involved in, I mean, there are a whole bunch of things, right? The scripts that we're being programmed with, and I'm inventing this language as I talk, by the way, this is not Foucault's. The scripts that we are programmed with are, according to Foucault, normalizing. In other words, we are all being asked to develop the capacity to enact a normal script. If you can't enact a normal script, then you are abnormal. And if you are abnormal, then special disciplinary mechanisms come into play. So, I mean, the example that I love to use is that of the, as we say now, although this was not a language that existed, even when Foucault was around, kids with ADHD, right? Those are kids who cannot enact the normal script for a school child. And so special measures have to be taken. And in our culture, those special measures tend to be psychopharmacological in character, right? They're given pills that help them concentrate or help them sit still or whatnot. But there are many other normalizing techniques. Sometimes involving force, but what defines them is not the application of force. So in a prison, for example, if a prisoner acts up, he may end up in solitary confinement. And of course, being confined somewhere is an act of force. But the purpose is not to visit punishment on the body of the prisoner, it's to normalize the behavior of the prisoner, to get him to be programmed correctly with the right script. So there are a whole set of these institutions, and I think that Foucault has a tendency to think about them as not unified, except through the dissemination of disciplinary technologies. So for example, the panopticon is first applied to the prison, and then hospital administrators begin to take notice. Now this is working in the prison, we can adapt it for our purposes. Or, the architect of modern schools begin to take notice, or whatnot. So you get a dissemination of disciplinary technologies from one institution to another. Foucault tends not to emphasize the other unifying character of disciplinary technologies, although I think you can find it in his work, but that is that they're all really geared toward disciplining people who must work and live in an increasingly industrialized and urbanized world. In other words, the disciplinary techniques are really techniques that come into existence with the rise of capitalism, not just capitalism, but industrial capitalism, which involves urbanization, right? City life. mental institutions and prisons and so forth are much more appropriate for cities than they are for traditional agricultural communities. Yeah, where you have the church, or you might have the parish schools, or even a county jail is different than a prison system, right? Okay. The purpose of this is to really program the micromuscular motions of people so that they can now fit in to what is a very new social form involving working factories and offices, obeying the rhythms of urban life, paying for your ticket before you get on to the MBTA, even though it's going to break down, and so forth and so on. So, okay, that's what structures the nature of disciplinary power. Now, surveillance is a technique of disciplinary power, in Foucault's framework. Surveillance is something that emerges from a particular technology, a specific technology, namely that of the panopticon. The panopticon, you remember, is the prison, originally proposed by Jeremy Bentham. There's a central watchtower where there are guards who cannot be seen because they're peering through little openings in the wall. And then there's a periphery of cells with the sun coming in, backlighting them, prisoners in the cells, bars that make the prisoners visible to the guards. The guards can see the prisoners, but the prisoners cannot see the guards. That's basically the structure of surveillance. And when you're being surveilled, you can be seen, but you cannot see who is seeing you. Even if it's... Now, I should say that some kinds of surveillance obviously are secretive. So people are taped or videotaped or recorded or whatnot without them knowing it. But increasingly in our society, surveillance is taking on a panoptical character, if you want to put it this way. So think about how many places have video cameras now that are trained on you. And there's a wide range of this. On street corners, so that you are being videotaped in public areas. On street corners, near traffic lights in some cases, if police have set up sort of speed traps. As you go through toll booths, as you enter supermarkets, many supermarkets now, especially in the cities, have surveillance cameras, and so do all kinds of retail outlets. I mean, the amount of, there was some astonishing figure that I read recently. I wish I had written it down, but something like, the average Bostonian is taped 50 times in the course of a day by video cameras. Yes? Right. In surveillance, in classical panoptical surveillance, right, you know you're being watched, but you don't know by whom or when. And essentially, I think this is the case for the video camera that's obvious to you, right? You look up in the bank and you see that you're being videotaped. Well, you know that your actions are being recorded. You don't know who is going to look at them, but even more importantly, you don't even know whether they're going to be looked at. Right? Because the problem, hold on a second, because the problem of surveillance is that to surveil everybody, in other words, to record and interpret the motions of everybody in the society would be prohibitively expensive. You'd have to have not just videotape cameras running, but you would have to have people analyzing the tapes. Now, what exactly is this guy doing here? Does he have a gun in his pocket, or is he just happy to see us? You have to interpret. Well, that means you have to hire interpreters. And this is one reason why the Big Brother state has never really worried me. The reason why is that, sure, let's say the government is recording everything we do. They don't know what the hell to do with that information. So, the problem is, and I think Bentham realized this, you could have a prison cell with a guard for every prisoner, watching them constantly, but that would be costly. And so what Bentham comes up with as a utilitarian is a social technology that's cheap. You only need one guard in the tower. as long as the person never knows when he or she is being watched. Well, you're constantly under surveillance in a bank. You just don't know whether anybody's going to be looking at the tape. But you know that the tape could be looked at. And so video cameras tend to have a regularizing effect. If you're a shoplifter, it seems to me that, you know, skilled shoplifters don't worry about being taped because they figure out ways to hide their actions, right? But for the vast majority of people who might be tempted to put something in their pocket, the fact that the tapes could be read by somebody, I would think, has an inhibiting effect. Because remember, the whole point of the panopticon, according to Foucault, is to get us to be our own guards. It's to get us to the point where we internalize the eye that is watching us. We begin to watch over our own behavior, to bring it into line with, you know, what I was calling the programmed scripts. And there, like I said, it doesn't matter whether the tapes are always being read. The fact that they could be read is what's inhibiting. So I think what you're getting here is a panoptical structure that's generalized, you know, across the society. This is something that I don't think Foucault really lived to see. You know, the ubiquitous presence of the video camera and also computerized forms of surveillance. But even the use of the computer is not, you know, that doesn't really solve anything. You can look through key, you can do computer visual recognition stuff where key patterns are recognized. But the problem with that is that there are always patterns that escape. There are always ways of doing things that don't come into accord with the pre-programmed patterns. So then what you need is people to write more software and people to interpret the software and to, you know, get the bugs out of it. And, you know, it's the same problem all over again. It's tremendously expensive to surveil everybody at every moment, right? So, but if you can get people to internalize the gaze of the person, of the watcher, that's the key. The key is to get people to regularize their behavior even though the tape is never going to be analyzed. Or even though they're not really being watched at that moment by the prison guard. And so that's really the brilliance of Bentham's proposal. And it's the brilliance of a structure of surveillance that's now widely in place. And more widely in place since 9/11, obviously. Okay. All right, let's say that this is true. This is a structure of power. Remember, for Foucault, disciplinary power is first and foremost a kind of power. And power is the ability to act upon the context that shapes other people's choices. But once again, remember, we are not billiard balls on a table. You know, you hit us with a certain amount of force in a certain direction and then just move that way. People, whatever the ultimate analysis of freedom of the will is, whether it means that we're not determined by natural causes or not, this is a big philosophical dispute. Whatever the final analysis of freedom of the will is, certainly on the most fundamental level, as human beings, we choose between alternatives. You know, whether our choices are somehow determined by other causes, deeply hidden natural causes or not, we make choices. So in order to exert power over people, the only way to really do it, I mean, you know, I can lift your body up and throw you against the wall, maybe, right, if you're light enough, but that's not power, it's just brute violence, right? The only way to really exercise power is to shape the context in which you choose. Now, you're going to choose whether or not to put something in your pocket if you're in a convenience store. Where all I can do is alter the context in which you make that choice. And how do I do it? I put in surveillance cameras. Now there's another context. There are other things you have to take into consideration. That is the exercise of power, according to Foucault. Whoever has the ability to shape the context holds the power. Now think about it. Why is the state powerful? Well, the state is powerful through its laws and through the ability to enforce its laws. And what that means, it changes the context in which we make our decisions. You know, are you going to not file your taxes? Well, you know, the IRS will come after you. And you can always not do it. You can always decide not to do it. But the context has been shaped by the state as an institution. The exercise of power involves shaping the context in which other people act. But Foucault's point is that there is never an unalloyed exercise of power that does not stimulate counterpower. Counterpower is a very important category in Foucault's analysis. And counterpower is basically what we would call resistance. You know, when the context has changed, people learn how to change it again. And then, of course, authoritative power has to learn how to outmaneuver that change. And then people learn. The classic instance of this, by the way, is the battles over the internet, on the internet, over possession of software, of films, of music, and so forth. Now, every time somebody develops a computer technique to copyboard something, right, to protect private property rights, somebody else figures out a technique to uncopyboard it. And then somebody else figures out a technique to copyboard it so that it can't be uncopyboarded with that technology. And then somebody else figures out it. So you see what I'm saying? There's always a counter. What move is made by agencies of power, there are counter moves that are made. Yeah.
How do you know the person who's making so you cannot copy, make that same software that can break it?
Exactly. Sometimes they do. It's quite both sides.
Take more money.
Oh, yeah. Absolutely. It's like the big corporations that give money to both the Democrats and the Republicans, so that whoever wins, they own. That's really hilarious. So. But yeah. But then, of course, that doesn't just happen. There are also groups that watch that and reveal it and expose it, and sometimes there are consequences for that. In other words, once again, there is never a simple exercise of power that simply dominates other people. Because people always have the capacity to fight back in various ways. Now, this brings us to an important point here but then of course the system then, whatever it is, the system of disciplinary power, can then also fight back. So what you get here is a struggle between forces. But the way to put this is to say that power is really a network of powers, a network of forces, which and a kind of game. I mean, I think probably a military game, chess, or even better, the Chinese game of Go. Go is played with these little stones placed on intersections on a board. And I forget how many there are a lot of stones and a lot of intersections, and it's a very hard game to learn because the pieces are not differentiated, so you have to learn patterns, right? But it was used to train generals in strategy. Power is like that. It's like putting black or white stones on intersections on a goal board. You know, it's your move, and then the other guy gets the move, and then it's your move, and then the other guy gets the move. A classic example of this, Foucault himself points out in his analysis of what happened to prison reform. Now, Bentham was a prison reformer, right? He says we're going to get people to normalize, we're going to get prisoners to normalize their behaviors by implementing the panopticon. The purpose of that is to rehabilitate, so that these guys go back into the general culture. Contributing members of society, well, what does that mean? That means people who have been programmed with the right scripts. Right? Foucault points out that ever since its origins, prison reform has been a miserable failure. Now, usually it's conservatives who point this out and want to go back to an older model of penal institution, which says that retribution is the point of prison and not reform. Foucault doesn't go there. He doesn't say that retribution should be adopted instead of rehabilitation. What he says is, what actually happens in prisons? In other words, Why is it that critics of prisons say that they don't work? Well, the whole thing really hangs on rates of recidivism, right? In other words, you release a so-called rehabilitated prisoner into the outside world, and you see how many of them are arrested and convicted of crimes again, how many return. And rates of recidivism are generally high. And they've always been high, and just as high after prison reform is implemented as before prison reform is implemented. Why? Foucault says you can say that prisons are failing at their function to rehabilitate, or you can say that they're succeeding at their function. But now the function is not to rehabilitate, the function is something else. The function is to do what they do well. And what they do well is produce a professional cast of criminals. Now, I mean, everybody knows this. You know, you send some kid to a prison who, on a lark, decided to steal an automobile. And he comes out a really good car thief. Right?
Oh, I thought when they're stealing a car the other day, it was awesome.
Well, that's
I was driving down the street.
Yeah.
I was in Salem. And
yeah.
I looked over and the guy, he bent down, crouched in a car, thinking the lock, and breaking the car. I was just like, oh, shit. And I was like, I gotta get out of here.
So, did you just left?
We were in like the ghetto part, so we were just driving through, but I've never seen that before.
So, you didn't think to call the police?
I thought about it, but I'm all set with like small.
What the hell? Yeah.
It's like that, like when he goes into, like, he got all that weed and he's like, I went into,
And he becomes a great cocaine dealer.
Right. It's exactly. What did he do? I went in with a degree in marijuana, came out with a master's in cocaine.
It came out, right, exactly. Yeah.
So.
Yeah, a high school degree in marijuana, out with a master's in cocaine.
Right. Exactly.
Yeah, no, that's exactly right, and that's in fact the way it functions. The reason why I'm not particularly impressed by your story is I used to live in New York. You know, for me, the question was stepping on the pedal when people pulled guns out. I remember cops in particular. I remember I was at a stoplight and a cop pulls out his gun and heads toward a car, and my wife said,
"That's kind of scary."
Go, you know, it's a red light, but go.
Well, I guess
so I did.
From that area, so I don't know.
That was on a major intersection on 14th Street and Broadway. But it's not. You know, I was not in a tucked away part of the city. You know?
I actually was in New York to go to a concert, and my friend and I got completely lost. We're on like 35th Street or something, and the judge didn't understand the pattern anyway. We went back, finally found the hotel. It was probably about 12:30 a.m. And a guy, I'm not even kidding, jumps out of like a trash bag, like in a trash can, like, you know, like all the trash that the hotel has in front of the place, and tried to hit on us. Like, I don't even know how he saw us. He just like jumped out.
This was in New York?
Yeah. It was in New York.
Are you going back?
So I must say, a really good show.
Or one of the actors, maybe. Why would prisons be successful, according to Foucault, because they produce a professional cast of criminals?
Well, because you have everybody who's doing the stuff outside and they go in for it, so you have just the prisoners and everybody, I guess, is really intense in there.
But they're going to be released, right, is the idea.
Well, if they are, but even just like the movies you see, like with the gangs or whatever, and then how you have people running stuff still from outside.
But why would that be successful? Why would that be a form of success, according to you? In other words, why would that be functional to the disciplinary regime?
If everyone comes out good, they don't have anything.
Yeah, exactly. If you really rehabilitate prisoners, you know, then the disciplinary institution vanishes. You see, there's a kind of an extra bonus here, because not only does recidivism justify prisons, but the existence of a professional cast of criminals justifies huge outlays on police departments. And of course, police departments, primarily what cops do is surveil. Think about it. You know, they will respond to calls and intervene, but primarily their function is to inhibit crime by being present. And so what you get is an extension of the surveillance structure from the prison to the outside world.
Yeah. So are you saying that, like, surveillance, the person should not be aware they're being watched?
No. What I'm saying is, in fact, the kind of surveillance that Foucault is interested in is the surveillance in which people know that they could be in the act of being watched.
Because my fiancé is an electrical designer, so he has to do fire alarms and stuff, cardio chips and malls and stuff.
There you go.
And he tells me about, like, how they're so high-tech, like the pan-tilt zoom ones that from, like, your house you can control where they look and everything.
That's true, yeah.
And another new, you know, technology is they have fake cameras, and they put up, like, a ton of them.
That's true, too. And that's an excellent example of a panopticon.
Or like a police officer sitting on the side of the highway, like it's just his car.
I noticed that. The camera, that's the fake camera, that's, you know, like 1,000 times cheaper than the real camera, but that people still regard as a camera, and therefore they regulate their behavior. Yeah.
At the airport, you'll see police in every terminal. You'll see police, car, but you don't see them inside.
Exactly. Same principle, right? It's the same principle. The point is not to, obviously it has to work, you have to have some functional cameras.
Yeah.
You have to have some cop cars with cops in them, right?
Mm-hmm.
But you can extend the effect at a fraction of the cost by doing things like that. The anti-cop car, the camera that does
so
the face camera.
Reduces the crime, right?
It reduces crime while costing little. In other words, you don't have to hire a new cop to sit in the car. You know, the other cops could be doing what they're supposed to be doing, which is like eating donuts.
I know.
It's a stereotype that's absolutely true.
Well, I used to work at when I was in high school, and they would come through the drive-thru, and they get free coffee already.
Yeah, right.
And they'd be like, oh, well, this is what they want. And they go on their computer, and they're on, like, AIM or whatever it is.
Yeah. Well, you see, I mean, in a way, I guess cops must internalize this idea that it really doesn't matter as long as people see them. You see the car. You know, it itself has an inhibiting effect. I mean, think about being on the highway and doing what I do, which is going 10, 15 miles above the limit, mm-hmm. right? Like all of Boston does, right? And now there's a cop car. Well, the guy in the car probably just wants to get home, right? You know, and it's like pissed that you slow down. But everybody slows down, yeah.
Well, I went to New York in 2003, and went to Manhattan in New York.
Yeah.
You know, like the bathroom. I don't know if people being marked there.
Yeah.
Because it's still not like when you're covered cops, you don't know who's...
Oh, yeah, right. Right.
So that's part of the civil...
That's part of the same idea, yeah. I remember when 9/11 happened, they had marshals on planes, right? And they made a big deal about announcing it. There were going to be marshals in plain clothes on planes. Well, they didn't have enough marshals to be on every flight. But the fact that they announced that there could be a marshal on a flight, they understood this would have an inhibiting effect.
So,
yeah, you could always be caught by a marshal. You know, there may not be a marshal on your flight, but there may be, right? Yeah, it's the same principle. Yeah. The counter stuff though, so here what you really have is prisoners who learn how to counter the disciplinary regime of the prison, and then the disciplinary system that learns how to make another counter move, namely to, you know, justify big police departments and extend surveillance and so forth to the general society. In other words, power is, it's not a stasis, it's always in motion. If you want to put it this way, although there's serious consequences for the exercise of power, it has the structure of a game, or the structure of a battle between forces. This thing, right? This is often, everybody's got one of these now, and almost everybody has a video camera built into it. Well, this means that you can videotape the police. And guess what? They don't like that. They don't like that. They can arrest you, but it's very easy to surreptitiously tape without being seen. And so the police now have to worry about being under surveillance.
Can they justify
No, they can't, but it doesn't matter. So they arrest you and then you issue, you know?
But why did they have such a problem with that?
Well, aren't you here, Ronnie King?
Well, yeah, of course. I didn't know if it was anything.
No, the police are often cutting corners and they don't want to be tested.
Like somebody on a highway intoxicated and they pulled them over and they tried to fight the cops, so they threw him on the ground and literally. Him.
Yeah, and the tape was shown. Yeah.
I just watched like a YouTube video of the tape in my last class.
Oh, no,
I had never seen it before.
Oh, yeah, it's amazing. They really did that. It's not getting the hell out of the mix.
Well, like, he was clearly on cross. Like, one guy hit him and he went down. He was out, and then they continued to hit him.
Kind of
and then, like, one of them, like, kind of, like, picked him up. So it was, he kind of was coming back. And hit him in the back of the head.
Yeah, it was brutal.
And
soft.
Hitting him.
And what happened was there was a guy with a video camera.
Yeah, across the street. You could take the whole thing.
Yeah. But what happened was the tape was shown on the news, and there it precipitated a riot in L.A.
What year was
it? What year was it?
91.
Yeah, it wasn't that long ago.
That happened too, I remember. Something like the cops, like it was a girl my size, and two of them just took her down and they kicked her. And her knee went the complete opposite way and completely destroyed it.
Yeah. Was that on tape as well?
Like, it
was on tape as well. Yeah, there's a number of cases like that on tape. But now, of course, I mean, in those days you had to actually have a video camera with you in 91. Now you just have to have your cell phone with you. Yeah.
There was some talk that the Rodney King video, they only showed like the ending. I don't think it's true, but what do you think about that?
Well, King was, Rodney King was an interesting guy, you know, because he said he was kind of a petty criminal, right? I mean, he had been in that jail, and undoubtedly he was drunk and so forth. But you see, nothing would have justified the police treatment.
Oh, absolutely not.
Absolutely nothing. You know, police use force in order to subdue somebody. They don't use force to to beat the shit out of somebody because they're pissed at him, right? I mean, that's prohibited, you know, by law.
What I heard was that they were on a high-speed chase, and obviously, not that this makes it okay at all.
Yeah, he refused to pull over.
Right, and they all have the adrenaline running.
Right, exactly.
Six cars behind you, and so as soon as they get you, you know,
But exactly, that's the whole point of being a police officer. I mean, what you do is you learn how to resist the adrenaline rush. And it's not impossible to resist it, you know? So the argument that I couldn't help myself is exactly the argument that the criminals that cops want to put away often use. Right?
That's what's scary. It's like, cops are just people. Like, they're not, you know, they have nothing to do with what we do except maybe some training. You know what I mean?
Yeah, but the training is what's significant, and it is possible to resist that. Yeah.
Not necessarily even the training. Like, if you look at the Stanford experiment with prison, you don't need training to treat people that way.
You don't need training to treat people badly. But what you do need is training to treat people well. In situations of stress. You want to talk about the Stanford? Is this the Milgram thing?
Stanford University, I think it was in the early 70s, did an experiment where they took a bunch of students and assigned them to be either prison guards or prisoners. And essentially, the people who took on the role of the prison guards abused their power, and they like starved the prisoners, and they mentally degraded them, and they had to stop the experiment halfway through. They couldn't even finish.
This is different than the Milgram experiment. The Milgram experiment was it was in a psych lab, and what happened was the students were involved. It was college students, so some students were told that they were going to administer shocks to other students and who were doing some kind of a repetitive activity. And the idea was if you could get the other student to do the repetitive activity faster, you would get more money for being involved in the program, right? Well, you could turn the shock level up. And, you know, until you heard sort of people yelling and screaming and so forth. And what happened was here, the tendency was for students not to turn the lever up until somebody in a white coat came in and said, go ahead and turn it up. And then they would do it. And what the experiment was meant to show was, it was actually more related to the concentration camp experience, that in response to authority, people can violate moral norms. And it wasn't that they wanted more money, it was that the person in the lab coat told them it was okay. You know, sort of like the Nazi leader who says it's okay to, you know, that kind of thing. So, yeah, I mean, unfortunately, there have been all kinds of situations like that. But the point is that good training should prevent that from happening. And it can, you know. Soldiers, for example, you often hear stories about how the stress of the battlefield is often invoked to explain inhumane behavior, like killing of civilians. But the truth is, that doesn't work. You know, in probably the greatest case of civilian wanton murder of civilians in recent American history, the My Lai case in Vietnam, it wasn't just that there was a troop that was killing the Vietnamese women and children. You know, there was also a helicopter pilot who came down and put himself between the guns and told his men to fire on the U.S. infantry unit if they kept on killing civilians. Now, in other words, people react differently to these things. And a soldier, at least a soldier who has some sense of a craft, of leading the military life, doesn't think of himself as a murderer. You know, he's got a stake in not thinking of himself as a murderer. It's like the Army JAG Corps who opposed the torture of prisoners in Guantanamo. That's not what soldiers do. Yeah, go ahead.
Oh, I was just—it's not really important.
No, okay, okay. Look, there is a third form of power, and this emerges in Foucault's later work. We've got two: sovereign power and disciplinary power. The third form of power is something he begins to analyze in a multi-volume work that he left unfinished at his death. And the multi-volume work is called The History of Sexuality. It's a brilliant work. The volumes that were actually completed are brilliant. It's an examination of sexuality in the ancient world and then in the early Middle Ages. And once again, Foucault is an historian philosopher. And so he draws philosophical consequences from his historical studies. Actually, I should back up a little bit. It's not just to the early Middle Ages. That's just the first two volumes. In later volumes, he projected a study that would go down to the 19th century, and in fact, he wrote a bit about that and other things, and was interviewed and so forth about it. And in this book, in this multi-volume work, he develops the concept of what he calls biopower. Biopower. This is also something that belongs to the modern period. Biopower is a form of the exercise of power that belongs to the modern period. What's significant about biopower is, first of all, its object. Its object is, as you might notice, biological. Bio here means life. And the significance of biopower is that it is the exercise of power over life, over the biological life process. Now, there are two dimensions that this takes in the early modern period, the period that Foucault himself writes about. One dimension is the regulation of sexuality. And by regulation of sexuality, what we mean is the regulation of personal sexuality, the sexuality of the individual, all through all kinds of ways. I mean, for example, sex becomes a topic of psychopathology for the first time in the modern era. Not just with Freud, but with Kraft Ebing, with people who come before Freud. So sexuality now becomes an indices of people's pathological behaviors. We'll talk about that. There are medical interventions in sexuality, the purpose of which is, for example, to prevent the spread of venereal disease. There are hygienic approaches to sexuality and so forth. So one dimension, and I'll just finish and we can go. One dimension is the regulation of the sexuality of the individual. The other dimension that's linked is regulation of the entire population. and in particular, the tracking and the attempt to influence birth rates. Those are, that doesn't happen prior to the modern era. You know, in the ancient world, the city-state doesn't try to regulate its population numbers. In the Middle Ages, the medieval village or city doesn't try to regulate its birth rates. But in the modern era, the tracking and the manipulation of birth rates becomes significant. And of course, those two intersect because birth rates are a function of sexual expression in some of its dimensions. And so we're going to look at that next time. We look at the structure of vital power in Foucault and how it relates to these other two dimensions of power. If you want to write on Foucault, you can be broader than the question that I wrote down on the website. You can write on bile power if you like. You can write about whether or not just police surveillance has been extended since 9/11, but whether or not we're living in a fundamentally new kind of culture of surveillance, in which surveillance is occurring by many different agencies and people and forces and so forth. You can expand it, is what I'm saying, if you want to. Yes?